Democracy Now!, one word, to 66866. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Noreen Shea, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 4:59 and 33 seconds, right there on the dot. Coming up next is your Friday evening news, but first.
Coming this June to the Monday Sampler.
Space Patrol!
Starting June 11th and continuing right through summer.
High adventure in the wild, vast reaches of space. Missions of daring in the name of interplanetary justice. Travel into the future with Buzz Corey, Commander-in-Chief of the Space Patrol.
Yes, the late-night radio show that comes on in the afternoon. The Monday Sampler will present Space Patrol.
Abby, can you hear me? Pull away from it.
I'm trying to, sir, but the rockets don't seem to have any effect.
Use full power on your starboard rocket.
I am, sir, but we're caught in some sort of a whirlpool.
Have hit full repeller ray. If you're caught in there, you're finished.
Tune in June 11th for our first exciting adventure.
Space Patrol story, The Hole in Empty Space.
And if you missed the broadcast, you can always go to kboo.fm to the audio archive. That's all right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Join KBOO and Kofallen Cultural Center on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for an evening of storytelling, live music, and film. Malian artist, author, and storyteller Baba Wage Jakite starts with a talk on the background of the Empire of Mali and the role of West Africa's oral historians before the screening of Keita, Heritage of the Griots, a film which blends modern events with magical realism, mythology, and history. Again, that's an evening of the culture of Mali, including the screening of the film Keita, Heritage of the Griots, on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, guess what? It's Friday, so it's time for your Friday Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, police shot and injured a citizen in the city of Almsville near Salem.
A second water advisory in Salem this week has Oregonians wondering, is this the new normal?
And we'll hear from the founder of Gladys McCoy Academy, a project of Oregon outreach that provides education for students who have not found success in the public school system.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 8th, 2018. I'm Jenna.
And I'm Zealous Marchant. A toxic algae bloom in Salem's water supply has Oregonians worried. Could climate change make disruptive events like this normal? KBOO volunteer Sam Bowman has this report from the Oregon News Service.
Salem residents are facing a crisis as the second drinking water advisory in 2 weeks went into effect this week due to a toxic algae bloom in Detroit Lake. Could climate change make emergencies like this more frequent for Oregonians? Algae blooms like the one in Detroit Lake are fed by warmer temperatures, something the country already is experiencing. Kathy Dello, Associate Director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute, notes May was the hottest on record in the United States, surpassing a 1934 Dust Bowl record. She says Oregon has been feeling the effects in recent years, too.
So if we think back to 2015, which was one of our worst droughts on record, some of the streams were so low that they got quite warm, and not only did we have fish kills, but we also saw things like algae blooms.
Last week, Governor Kate Brown activated the National Guard to distribute safe drinking water to Salem residents. The latest advisory is more limited in scope, applying to vulnerable populations such as children under six, pregnant women, and people with compromised immune systems. Algae blooms have become a growing problem for cities' drinking water supplies across the country. But Dello says it's not just water quality that is suffering under climate change. Oregon has seen decreased snowpacks and more severe droughts and wildfires. She says the first step to mitigating these effects is reducing carbon emissions, which Oregon has committed itself to doing.
Also, we have to look at adaptation. Climate change is happening. It's already impacting Oregonians. So we need to prepare for a rapidly changing future.
Dello says the growing effects of climate change have public health impacts, which will become costly for cities to address. In the case of drinking water, she says it could be low-income families who suffered the most when they can no longer rely on their taps and have to turn to some other, more expensive source. For KBOO Evening News, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, I'm Sam Bowman.
This morning, the Oregon State Police announced that a citizen received, quote, minor injuries when they were shot by an Almsville police officer. Almsville, with a population of just over 3,500, is located southeast of Salem in Marion County. According to OSP, the shooting occurred at about 1:30 this morning when an Almsville officer stopped a vehicle on Bates Road, east of the intersection with West Staten Road. Beyond that, details are very scarce. The press release states only that, quote, at some point during the stop, shots were fired from the officer, unquote. The citizen received minor injuries and the officer was unhurt. No other information, including the names of either party, were released. According to Marion County's post-deadly physical force plan, the Oregon State Police will lead the investigation into the shooting. It is the fourth officer-involved shooting in Marion County this year and the 18th in Oregon overall.
Almsville's police department has only 14 members, 9 of whom are reserve officers, according to the State Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, or DPSST. The home security consulting company Safewise declared Almsville the fourth safest country in Oregon last year. Police Chief Richard Smits attributes this to the small city hiring a sixth police officer in 2016. According to KATU, thought it was unclear who this officer is from, DPSST records, which show only 5 non-reserve officers. The city and chief are currently asking its residents to pay a public safety fee to help fund the sixth officer and the hiring of a seventh officer. The fee was approved by the city council last month, prompting citizen Derek Clevenger to start a change.org petition to have the fee put on the November ballot. So far, it has gotten 400 signatures. Clevenger and others are upset that the fee may negatively impact households that cannot afford it, since the approved ordinance would penalize the households by shutting their water off. Clevenger also points out that according to the Chief Smith's own data, calls to the Almsville Police have not increased in 4 years, and 25% of current calls are for support in neighboring cities.
For 30 years, Oregon Outreach has provided academic support to adults and youth in Oregon to help them earn their high school diploma. The organization provides accredited academic program and support systems to lead students to succeed in the classroom, at home, and in the community. Rebecca Black, the executive director of Oregon Outreach, began working with youth in North and Northeast Portland over 25 years ago. She was surprised to learn that there were very few options for youth outside of school. Working with the Office of Alternative Education, Special Director Services, and Juvenile Parole and Probation, Becky established a school program for gang-affiliated and gang-affected youth. It provided pre-employment training and job placement. She went on to establish 2 more satellite schools, Alberta Learning Center for middle schoolers and Simpson Learning Center for students with drug and alcohol dependency. In 1993, the programs merged to become the Gladys McCoy Academy. Gladys McCoy Academy now has programs in Portland, Molalla, Scappoose, and Vernonia. KBOO's news director Zelos Zelos-Marchant spoke to Rebecca Black yesterday about the academy and joined event this weekend celebrating Gladys McCoy's class of 2018 and the torch passing of the International Freedom Flame.
All right. Let's circle back to the name of your school.
Okay.
Gladys McCoy Academy, which we were talking earlier about. A lot of people around a certain age may not know about Gladys McCoy. Who was she?
Gladys McCoy was a wonderful figure here in Northeast Portland, her and her husband. She was the first woman of color on the Portland School Board, the first woman of color on the county commissioners, and she eventually became chair of the commission. Her husband was a state senator, and they raised, I believe, 7 children while doing all this work in their communities. And so when we named our school in 1988, our students had to pick a name. And at that time, Clyde Drexler was a famous trailblazer. So it came down to Gladys and Clyde. But it ended up them saying, we want a name after somebody here in our own community. And so they picked Gladys McCoy Academy. And I've always said, I never dreamed at some age I would have a school named Gladys. But we do, and we're proud of it.
I think it's wonderful. And just so wonderful that you're connecting kids with challenges in their communities to get higher learning.
Thank you. There are so many youth who drop out or at risk of dropping out for many reasons. Many, it's lots of trauma in their lives. Mm-hmm. Some, a whole comprehensive high school with big classes and not a lot of individual attention is too much. Mm-hmm. So our schools are very small. There's lots of individual attention, high staff number to student ratio. And we help them deal with the emotional and the traumas in their lives and work with them one-on-one. And Tuesday night's our graduation, again, at Warner Pacific University McGuire Auditorium, where we get to see 20-some students walk across the stage, get their diplomas, and it's very heartwarming and makes all the struggles worthwhile.
I bet. Is your organization thinking of expanding to other rural communities?
We've helped about 15 different school districts in the past. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we go in and help them set up an alternative program. Some adopt our model and continue to use that model and have their own programs. But we expand as we're made aware of a need. And there are lots of needs, but sure. Then there's it depends on funding, if districts can afford. But we believe it's worth it that those might be a few students we serve. But even if we see one of them succeed, and one of our speakers at graduation this year will be a woman named Callie Love, who's an advisor, policy advisor to Loretta Smith, who is a county commissioner. And she was a McCoy student, and so mm-hmm. she's going to talk to the students about her struggles and how she overcome them and where she is now. And we have so many past students with so many great stories of their success.
I have so many questions and only so much time. But when a school is interested in partnering with your organization to better serve their students that are having lots of, you know, all the different challenges that you mm-hmm. were touching upon, you know, how do they go about doing that? And in those instances that there's not funding, is there capabilities then to do grants? I mean, is it collaborative? How does this work?
Actually, even in all those districts where we receive, where we have a contract and receive funding, we still need to be continually writing grants, and mm-hmm. people here at KBOO can understand that.
It's
donations and grants. Mm-hmm. And so at our 30th, we actually have a silent auction and a raffle and a donation. A place to donate, and so it's continual. Mm-hmm. We receive a portion of basic student support in those districts, so it's a lot less than what a district gets per student. So it's always we have to always continue to get community support. That's mm-hmm. how we stay alive.
Do you ever have students that are out of a district but have heard of your school and want to attend, and then what happens?
If they're in a district where we contract, the district will have to go – they'll go through a process to come into that district. Okay. Here in Portland, where we don't have a contract with PPS, students can come to us from all over, and they do. We serve mainly Portland Public School students, but we also have students that come from further out.
Neat. Oh. Wow, goodness. Is there anything else you'd like our audience to know about all the fabulous things that you're doing?
I love to hear from people. Maybe I could give you an email and a phone number if anybody wants to donate, volunteer.
Yeah, sure.
We're always looking for volunteers. You can reach me at 503-281-9597, and my email is rblack@oregonoutreach.org.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking to Rebecca Black, the founder and executive director of Oregon Outreach Incorporated, about the 30th anniversary and a graduation coming up of the Gladys McCoy students and the Freedom Flame that's all coming through town. That's a lot. So definitely check it out. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you for letting us for helping us get the word out. We would like to hear from people who have an interest in the work that we're doing.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, a production of the Center for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's Bread and Roses, featuring author Jackie B. Peterson, talking about strategies for solo and creative entrepreneurs. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will see a low of 51 with a 100% chance of rain, which prompts the question, if it's 100%, can you call it chance? Tomorrow we will see a high of 62 and an 80% chance of rain. Today in history, in 1918, a solar eclipse was visible in totality across the contiguous United States and was officially observed by the U.S. government from Baker City, Oregon. And in 1949, George Orwell's dystopian novel 1984 was published. The quote of the day is from George Orwell, who said, quote, "Every war, when it comes or before it comes, is represented not as a war, but as an act of self-defense against a homicidal maniac," end quote.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 18th, 2018.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is June 8th. On this day in 1968, Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing, performed by Tammy Terrell and Marvin Gaye, one of the most popular duos in popular music, became the number one R&B song. Written by Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson, the lingering melody of the classic song stands the test of time and rose to the number one slot within weeks of its release.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365. Bam! 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
Black History 365 is a production of KPFT Houston, a listen-sponsored community radio station.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Northern Arapaho Elder Society recently presented a statement at a public hearing expressing disapproval of Wyoming's grizzly bear hunt. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports the statement called such hunting an act of genocide against the species.
Elders Crawford White Sr. and Nelson White Sr. stated that as a sovereign nation, the federal government should have consulted them in the decision as required by law. Rocky Mountain Tribal Leadership Councilman Sergio Maldonado says his elders say that instead of hunting bears to control their population in Yellowstone, they should be moved to reservations like Wind River. He says, sure, that could impact farmers and ranchers on the reservation.
Should those bears come down and take out cattle, well, the law of the land is, you know, the owners of the cattle, the ranchers, kill the bears. But they have no problem in the grizzlies coming on to our reservation because at least we know they're protected.
Maldonado says the council requested the statement as a show of respect for the Northern Arapaho's unique elder society.
The other tribes recognize our old men, the elder society, as extremely legitimate, as foundationally spiritual in that old way.
The Northern Arapaho are only one of a handful of tribes to be officially governed by its elders this way. Maldonado presented the elder's statement to the Wyoming Game and Fish Commission, but he says the statement didn't change the vote on grizzly hunting.
It's already written in the stars as to what they were going to do. This was nothing more than a political and duplicitous public hearing.
Maldonado says the elders feel trophy hunting is unethical and sacrilegious. He says they've also requested he submit their statement to Wyoming's Governor Matt Mead as well. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
The Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde are celebrating the return of 16 artifacts from Europe. As KLCC's Brian Bull explains, the items are back after nearly 120 years, but not permanently.
Between 1870 and 1910, two men, Minister Robert Summers and Indian agent Dr. Andrew Kershaw, acquired various baskets and bowls from the tribal members they served. A colleague eventually bought the artifacts and gifted them to London's British Museum. Now those objects are on display at the Grand Ronde Tribe's own museum. David Harrelson is the Tribal Cultural Resources Manager. He says in a year, they'll go back to London.
Yeah, the objects will go back. We'll retain 3D scans of the objects, which we'll be able to use. To us, you know, the important thing to retain is the cultural practices that go along with them. We're interested in living things and being a living culture, not a dead culture.
The tribe has worked for 2 decades to reacquire the artifacts. Part of the efforts involved upgrading and expanding the tribal museum. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
A shelter was set up Thursday on the Mescalero Apache Reservation in New Mexico due to the Soldier Canyon fire. As of early Friday morning, the fire had burned more than 2,500 acres. The evacuation site is at the Mescalero Apache Community Center. Tribal offices are closed as crews battle the blaze. The Senate Committee on Indian Affairs this week favorably reported the nomination of Tara Sweeney to serve as Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs at the Interior Department. It passed by a voice vote and now goes to the full Senate for consideration. Sweeney, who's Alaska Native, was tapped by the Trump administration in October. The Indian Affairs Committee held a hearing on her nomination in May. Ranking members of the committee are urging the Senate to move swiftly to confirm her. The National Congress of American Indians is also calling for final approval. NCAI says the vacancy of a leader for Indian Affairs at the federal agency has caused undue stresses on the government-to-government relationship with tribes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
We suspect that it's been a challenging week for the 45th President of the United States. He's had inane tweets to author and football players to demean. And we hope that he's been preparing for what's expected to be an antagonistic G7 meeting in Canada, followed by the summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore. But the constant in Trump's ever-changing world is the public incompetence of his staff. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has this observation.
In a week where Donald Trump publicly declared his absolute power to pardon himself from any crime, then accused the FBI of planting a spy in his campaign, and finally asked Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau if the Canadians had burned down the White House during the War of 1812, it would be easy to once again go after the president's weak grasp of history, the facts, or the truth. But the thing that stuck out the most to me was that this has been another week to remind us that some of Trump's greatest failures revolve around his staffing decisions. It's been said that one trait of effective leaders is their willingness to surround themselves with advisors who have expertise and skill sets that they lack, or who are willing to push back on the leader. But as we've seen, disagreement is considered disloyalty and is not tolerated by Trump, and he apparently always needs to see himself as the smartest person in the room. And that need has caused him to set a low bar when it comes to filling out his team. Betsy DeVos, Scott Pruitt, Ryan Zinke, and Ben Carson, to name just a few, are clearly intellectually weak cabinet members. And the latest weak link in the administration's chain is former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. In less than 2 months on the team, Giuliani has undermined the president's claim of not being involved in the Stormy Daniels case by admitting that Trump repaid Michael Cohen the $130,000 in hush money that his lawyer paid to the adult film star.
That money was not campaign money. Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
He then claimed that this kind of behavior was common for lawyers.
This is the kind of thing that I've settled for celebrities and famous people. Every lawyer that does that kind of work has.
Greenberg Traurig, the law firm from which he had taken a leave of absence to, quote, help the president, strongly disagreed with Giuliani, and he left the firm by mutual agreement, although most assume he was fired. Just this past Sunday, during an interview on Meet the Press, he said that the reason Trump shouldn't testify is because his story keeps changing.
This is the reason you don't let the president testify. Our recollection keeps changing.
And yesterday, Rudy took it to another level with this comment during an interview in Israel.
Well, Kim Jong-un got back on his hands and knees and begged for it, which is exactly the position you want to put him in.
You may recall that less than 2 weeks ago, the North Koreans walked away from the summit after Security Advisor John Bolton and Vice President Mike Pence made thinly veiled threats comparing Kim Jong-un's future to that of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi if he didn't make a deal with the U.S. Gaddafi was later killed by NATO-backed Libyan rebels. Based on his history of belligerence, it seems unlikely that North Korea leader Kim came crawling back to Trump to get the meeting back on. I expect there was give and take on both sides, as evidenced by the fact that the U.S. is already backing off its demands that North Korea immediately give up its nuclear weapons in exchange for relief from U.S.-led sanctions. But even if North Korea did initiate the dialogue that led to the resumption of talks, what could possibly be gained by characterizing their actions in such a condescending manner? With the first 500 days of the Trump presidency now behind us, the fact that his actions might actually lead to a breakthrough with North Korea is the only glimmer of light in the nearly endless darkness of his administration. Trump complains about the steady flow of leaks coming out of the White House, but the public statements from his incompetent staff frequently causes far greater damage. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Now it's time for Middle East Minute Plus, a daily roundup of stories relating to the Middle East and Middle Eastern diasporas, produced by KPFK North Hollywood and Jewish Voice for Peace.
I'm Esti Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. German prosecutors have issued an international arrest warrant for a top Syrian intelligence officer accused of overseeing the torture and murder of hundreds of detainees. German magazine Der Spiegel describes the warrant for the arrest of Jamal Hassan, head of Syria's notorious Air Force Intelligence Directorate and close ally of President Bashar al-Assad, as the most serious effort yet by a Western country to hold Assad's regime accountable for crimes committed against Syrians since a 2011 uprising for civil rights sparked a brutal proxy war. Students at UC Davis are fighting back against threats and cyberbullying by Canary Mission, a shadowy website that aims to tarnish the reputations of educators and students who speak out for Palestinian rights and compromise their future careers. Almost 1,900 students, professors, and community activists have been added to the website, according to civil rights group Palestine Legal. The UC Davis Student Senate passed a resolution last month that aims to safeguard students' rights to engage in political activism. The resolution states that Canary Mission and similar sites threaten the security of student activists as well as create a toxic atmosphere of fear and paranoia among fellow students, thus infringing upon students' ability to freely express their opinions. It also condemns student organizations that inform on fellow students to groups like Canary Mission and denounces surveillance and intimidation on campus by police and U.S. immigration authorities. And Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has announced an unconditional ceasefire with the Taliban to last until June 20th. The ceasefire comes after an attack on Monday claimed by ISIS killed 14 people who gathered for a clerics' peace summit in Kabul. This is President Ghani's first unconditional offer to a ceasefire since his election in 2014. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Sam Bowman, and myself, Zelis Marchant. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer and my co-anchor is Jenna Yokoyama! The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is myself, Zelis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Zelis.
And I'm Jenna. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, more talk radio. And then at 9, during Political Perspectives, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with your host, Chris Andre. Then at 10:30, it's Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Health Watch, followed by Madness Radio at 11:30. Thanks, KBOO members, for all your generous support. If you've thought about becoming a member but you haven't, you can go online to kboo.fm and click on that donate button and become a sustaining part of your community radio. Well, have a good night, Zelis.
Good night, Jenna.
And time for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that a Denver baker was not legally liable for his refusal, based, he claimed, on religious beliefs, to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple. It wasn't that Jack Phillips' free speech would have been violated, the court's majority said in their decision on Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission, and it isn't that it's legal for businesses to discriminate against LGBTQ people. But members of the commission had exhibited hostility toward Phillips' religion. One supposed smoking gun being a commissioner's statement that religion had historically been used as an excuse to hurt others, and thus they'd violated his right to its free exercise. So, a narrow ruling that should be read mainly as an affirmation of human rights, or a foot in the door for a legal perspective that argues that demanding equal rights can be construed as constraining the liberties of those who say equal rights are against their religion. We'll hear about Masterpiece Cake Shop from Jennifer Pizer, Law and Policy Director for Lambda Legal. And that's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. 8 overt white nationalists are running for office in 2018, a new record, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. Overt fascists, inspired by the rise of Donald Trump, have found a place both within and just outside the margins of the official Republican Party. Over 20,000 people voted in a GOP primary this past March for former American Nazi Party member Art Jones, making him the Republican candidate for the House in Illinois' 3rd District. Patrick Little, who told NBC that the, quote, monstrous nature of the Jewish people must be known to the public,